Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the podcast. It's Justin Brierley sitting in for Ruth Jackson this week and bringing you someone other than Alistair McGrath on the show today. For the next few weeks, in fact, we'll be hearing from some other great thinkers and exponents of C.S. Lewis. And today is C.S. Lewis scholar Michael Ward. You'll hear my conversation with him shortly. Before we get there, you may be aware that the C.S. Lewis podcast is part of the Premier Unbelievable family of shows and resources. Well, I'd love to invite you to join me for Unbelievable Live for a Q&A with another great thinker and Oxford professor, John Lennox. You can join from anywhere in the world on Tuesday, the 7th of December at 7 p.m. UK, that's 2 p.m. Eastern, to be part of it. We're going to be talking about God, science and faith, and taking your questions. We'll also hear about the new video documentary of John's life, Against the Tide, in partnership with the film's producers, Caris Productions and Pensmore Films. Now, if you like C.S. Lewis and Alistair McGrath, I think you'll love Unbelievable Live with John Lennox, who incidentally was a student at Cambridge in Lewis's final years there and can tell you some great stories about his lectures. It's free to register at unbelievable.live. And there's a link with today's show. I'd love to see you there. For now, here's my conversation with Michael Ward. The C.S. Lewis scholar and Oxford-based priest is well known for his work on Planet Narnia, uncovering the secret planetary code that Lewis hid in the Narnia stories. And Michael has a new book out, After Humanity, a guide to C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man, from Word on Fire Publishing, and he joined me to talk about it. So good to see you again, Michael. I mean, you like me, I'm sure, have, you know, not been able to go very far afield. You're usually dotting all over the place between the US and the UK and so on. But I suspect things have been rather more home-based for the last 18 months or so.
Yes, I have been rather confined, cabined, cribbed and confined, as Shakespeare has it. And I would have been to America at least three times by now, but they've all been cancelled. It's very annoying. But thank goodness I haven't had the COVID, and right. Very few people I know have had it. So,
if you have to be confined to Oxford, it's not a bad place to be confined, you know.
Indeed, and I have a pleasant enough house, so I'm very fortunate. Yeah,
absolutely. There's obviously so many Oxford connections with your life. Tell us about how you became the person you are, one of probably the best known C.S. Lewis scholars in the world. I hope I'm not embarrassing you saying that, Michael, but tell us, where did your love for C.S. Lewis come from originally?
Probably the same place that it comes for most people, in that the Narnia books were read to me by my parents when I was a little boy. And I loved them and read them for myself when I was old enough to do so. Except in my case, I never stopped reading or rereading Lewis. I moved from Narnia to his other fiction, to his apologetics, to his academic writings, then got interested in his life, his biography, his letters, I did an English degree here at Oxford, and so I began to study him a bit more formally at that point. And when it came time for me to do my PhD, Lewis was the obvious choice. And so, without any real deliberation, I've ended up having my whole career sort of focused on Lewis and his writings. And I'm pleased with how it's worked out.
There's a whole other shows I could direct people to from years gone by when we've talked through the great thesis of yours on, you know, unveiling a sort of secret code of sorts behind the Narnia stories and the planetary schema that Lewis appears to have hidden within those books. But that's for people to go and discover for themselves. I'll try and leave a link with today's show where you can find out more about that and about your own book, Planet Narnia, and so on. But you've continued writing and researching and all sorts. I mean, your latest book, which we'll come to in a moment, is based on The Abolition of Man, but it's published through Word on Fire. Tell us about Word on Fire and your own connection with this, because this some way ties in with your own spiritual journey as well, doesn't it? And where you've gone yourself theologically and in terms of your churchmanship, as it were.
That's right, yes. So my book on the abolition of man is called After Humanity, and it's published by Word on Fire, Word on Fire Academic, to be precise. They've got this new academic line going. And Word on Fire is a Catholic ministry. And I, in addition to being an academic, I am a Catholic priest. And I became a Catholic in 2012 after a lifetime's Anglicanism. And indeed, I was an Anglican priest for several years. I was a chaplain first at Cambridge and then here at Oxford. And then I swam the Tiber and eventually ended up as a Catholic priest. And I, as it were, I ride two horses abreast. I help out in a local parish, but I also am based here at one of the colleges at Oxford, where I'm based for my academic work. But I also, as it happens, teach online for Houston Baptist University.
There you go. You cover all the bases, don't you?
Houston Baptists are very ecumenical. They're happy to have Catholics on their faculty. So I teach for them online in their MA program in apologetics.
Yeah, yeah. Was Lewis ever tempted to swim the Tiber?
I don't think so, no. I mean, he was very Catholically inclined as an Anglican in certain respects. You know, he had a high view of the Eucharist, a high view of the priesthood. He went to confession. He believed in purgatory. But he, I think, never had any serious inclination to swim the Tiber, no.
Mm. Talking of Lewis and his life, again, before we come to your book, Michael, I understand there's a film that's been recently, in fact, I think it was about a year ago, I seem to remember the filming was taking place for this in and around Oxford, a new film of Lewis's life and especially his conversion story. Tell us a bit about that and the role that you've played in it as well.
The film is called The Most Reluctant Convert, and it's based on a one-man stage play starring Max McLean, which has had considerable success in the United States. And it's now being made into a film with more than just one cast member. In fact, there are three actors playing C.S. Lewis as a boy, a young man, and the old man. It focuses on his conversions, first of all, to theism and then to Christianity. It's all drawn very closely from Surprised by Joy, Lewis's autobiography. And it's very close up to the facts. It's very faithful to the historical record. And very well cast as well. All three C.S. Lewis's are brilliantly cast. The young man, Lewis, is played by Nicholas Ralph, who's just shot to stardom as James Herriot in this new version of All Creatures Great and Small. And I was asked to play a small part as C.S. Lewis's vicar, as his parish priest here in Oxford, at the church he went to, Holy Trinity, Headington Quarry, and we were able to film in the real church. And Lewis's body is buried in the churchyard there.
Don't they have an engraving in one of the windows dedicated to Lewis?
They do, yes. Near the pew where he sat, there's a small etched window with figures from Narnia engraved in it. Yeah, it was filmed by, it was directed by
Norman Stone,
who of course made the original BBC Shadowlands about C.S. Lewis, which won BAFTAs and
wasn't he involved in a production involving your own work as well?
Yes, that's exactly how the invitation came about, because Norman Stone made a documentary about my book Planet Narnia called The Narnia Code for the BBC, and when he knew he was making this new film that would be set in Oxford, he thought, Michael used to be an Anglican priest. He's now a Catholic priest. He could probably play the part of a priest. And indeed, not only did I do that, I even brought my own vestments.
Fantastic. There you go.
So you were props department as well.
I was. Yeah, it was fantastic.
I'm really looking forward to it. I understand it's scheduled for November in the US release. Not exactly sure which platforms it will be appearing, hopefully in the UK as well before too long as well. But yes, I'm very excited about that. I do know Max a little bit as well. And I know this, I'm sure will be really great to see what has been a fabulous stage play kind of transformed for the screen as well. So yeah.
I've seen it twice now in previews, and it was shown to cast and crew first, and then there was a private screening here at Magdalen College, Oxford, where a lot of it was filmed. And on both occasions, I liked it. I liked it more even the second time, which is a good sign.
Yes.
And yeah, I think it's definitely going to be worth seeing, much more so than the recent Tolkien biopic, which I thought was terrible.
Right. Yes. They varying quality, aren't they? When it comes to exactly who decides what kind of spin to put on these different biopics. But my one small C.S. Lewis acting claim to fame is that I was the understudy to Douglas Gresham, playing the role of Douglas Gresham in Shadowlands when I was sort of 10 or 11 in a local repertory theatre. So I did play, because we were both young, the two people playing the part, I did about a third of the performances. Uh-huh. And and that stayed with me. You know, I think at the time I wasn't in a position to recognise exactly all the thematically what was going on in, but as an adult and reflecting back, and it has stayed with me, you know, that whole experience of playing that role.
Excellent. What
I thought was actually a very good stage play. I mean, ways I thought the stage play better than the actual film with Anthony Hopkins, you know.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it went through several iterations, first as a TV film, then as a stage play, then as the feature film. And I agree with you that of the three, probably the stage play was the best, not least actually because it's the longest. Mm. It has had more time to develop the theme.
Yeah.
But have you ever met the real Douglas Gresham?
Well, I have. I've also had the opportunity to interview him at least once. This was going back several years when the Narnia films were being produced by Disney and so on. But that was a bit weird, meeting the man in the flesh that you've played as a boy on stage. But there you go. Let's talk about your new project, After Humanity, A Guide to C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man. So to my shame, even though I count myself a fan of C.S. Lewis, I hadn't up until this year actually read The Abolition of Man. But it's not a long read. It's sort of an extended essay, really, isn't it? But do you want to sort of give a flavour of what it is, sort of where it falls within, you know, C.S. Lewis's canon, as it were, and what someone could expect if they read it for the first time?
Yeah, I'm not wholly surprised that it's taken you so long to read it, because it is a relatively little known work and a relatively difficult work. It's Lewis in philosophical mode. It's based on three lectures in philosophy that he gave during the Second World War. And it's not an explicitly Christian apologetic. He's basing his argument purely on philosophy and reason and logic and history, and it doesn't get as far as a belief in God, let alone a belief in the Christian God. All he's trying to do is defend the objectivity of value. Mm. That is to say that, you know, things have value in and of themselves, regardless of what you and I might prefer to think about them. You know, there's aesthetic value. That waterfall, for instance, is truly beautiful in and of itself. This statement is objectively true, and you know, certain moral actions are objectively good. The good, the true, and the beautiful, these values are objective. They're not just subjective projections from our own preferences.
And what was Lewis specifically responding to in his own time? Because he sort of begins the whole book kind of, you know, almost railing against a sort of particular textbook that he's come across. This seems to have been the thing that sparked his thoughts. So what was he seeing in his day and age when it came to people claiming everything is subjective when it comes to values?
Yeah, I mean, he starts off with directing his fire against this school textbook, which he calls the Green Book, though it was in reality called The Control of Language. But that's really just a springboard. That's a foil into his argument. what he's really tackling is not, you know, school textbooks, but the whole drift in Western thought over the last several centuries, really, towards an increasingly subjectivist approach to reality. So it's a very large-scale argument that he's making, but, you know, clever rhetorician, great stylist that he was, he starts with something small and particular, a school textbook that we can all recognize as, you know, something that we will have interacted with, and you know, gradually unfolds his argument from there. And, I mean, it has become very widely recognized and admired as an attack upon subjectivism and as a defense of objectivity, partly because it's so very philosophical. Because it's not an explicitly Christian or even theological work, it attracts a wide readership. You don't have to be a Christian or a theist to enjoy what he's doing there.
Mm. So how does this manifest itself today? Would you say, you know, that has only continued, that trend that he was obviously noticing when he gave these lectures in the Second World War?
Absolutely, yeah. It's described as a prophetic and a prescient work. And rightly so, because I think what Lewis saw as being underway in the 1940s has only really accelerated in the decades since. So that, you know, a few years ago, the Oxford Dictionary's word of the year was post-truth. We now live in a post-truth society. And that, you know, that linguistic development shows you, I think, how things have changed since Lewis's day.
Yeah. What then are you trying to do? Obviously, people can read the book themselves. In fact, I think the book, your own book, Your Guide, is coming with a newly sort of printed, a newly minted version of The Abolition of Man. And your book, I think, is actually bigger, you know, than Lewis's book, you know, as a commentary on it. What are some of the key things that you're drawing out for today's reader of The Abolition of Man?
Yes, my book is considerably longer than Lewis's. Lewis's is about 20,000 words, and my book is more like 80,000 words. But I think that's not because I'm just, you know, flogging a dead horse or labouring a point. It's because there is so much packed into Lewis's work, pound for pound, word for word. It's one of his densest pieces of argumentation. So it does take a lot of unpacking. And you know, there are a lot of just sort of allusions and things taken for granted in Lewis's work, which the average reader won't know about. And, you know, I didn't know about until I did my research. I learned a lot in putting this book together. And because I'm not a philosopher myself, I don't take anything for granted about what readers of Lewis will find difficult, because I find it difficult myself. And I've noticed that my own students also, though they recognize that this is an important and significant work, they can't often get their teeth into it. I've provided this guide. And if anyone wishes to buy After Humanity from the publisher, Word on Fire, then they automatically get this tie-in edition of The Abolition of Man with a complimentary cover, so that they're matching books. And what I try to bring out, was that your next question?
Yeah. What are some of the key lessons for you that The Abolition of Man has? I've seen it being quoted quite frequently, actually, in the last 18 months, from various apologists and thinkers. And Lewis has always been that master, hasn't he, of that encapsulating an idea in a way that it does fit into an Instagram post or a Facebook post or whatever. But what would you say were some of the kind of takeaways for you as you researched the book that you thought, yes, this is like Lewis speaking to our condition right now?
Well, I think the principal takeaway is that if value is indeed subjective, if we do indeed just project value onto the world from our own preferences, our own whims, our own opinions, our own willpower, then there's really no such thing anymore as rational debate, because to debate with someone about reality requires both you and the person you're talking with to recognize that there's something outside each of you, which between you, hopefully, you can come to a better understanding of. But there can be no better or worse understanding of reality if reality is entirely projected from inside each one of us. What are we talking about? It's basically a kind of solipsism that results from a thoroughgoing subjectivist approach to reality. So that itself is a really dangerous philosophical thing to embrace, because it leads to conflict. It leads to war. It leads to, you know, sheer willpower. If I can't persuade you rationally, and you can't persuade me rationally, then all we can do is lock horns, and the stronger one of us will dominate the weaker through sheer force majeure. And that's not the way to freedom and peace.
I mean, where I see this potentially playing out in some way in a modern culture is you have the kind of the secular side who are all for science, and that is our guide, and that is objective reality, and we need to measure everything by that objective reality. That's their kind of, and then you often find them locking horns with other secular folk who are, you might argue, more subjectivist in their approach, and say, no, we impose all our own values, you know, on everything, and we're all a product of our situation and culture, and you know, you see this rolling through, especially in the areas of gender identity and sexuality and so on at the moment, where you can't, you know, I'm allowed to label myself, you know, a woman if I feel that I am a woman inside, and I don't care what the biology or the science says about that. You know, that's an internal feeling or whatever. I mean, perhaps Lewis didn't anticipate these specific debates that we're now seeing play out, you know, in culture today, but presumably you think they're quite relevant to his thought.
Absolutely. They are the outworkings of those things that he was putting his finger on back in the 1940s. And although I think he would have been amazed at the speed with which these gender questions have arisen, I don't think he would have been surprised by the fact that they have arisen. Because one of his chief considerations, I think, as a philosopher, was questions of gender. You know, the Ransom trilogy, his trilogy of interplanetary adventures, sometimes called the Space Trilogy, is all about gender. That's the main theme. And he had a very strong view about the necessity to recognize the reality of masculinity and femininity. And if we did not, he said, we will soon find out that not that we are playing with them, but that they are playing with us. You know, these are mystical, archetypal realities, transcendental, metaphysical realities, gender identities, that is, and we should not mess about with them.
And to that extent, as society has moved in some respects in that subjective direction, we are seeing these now, you know, heated debates taking place about this whole thing. I mean, would Lewis be any more a fan of the, you know, the secularist who's all about the science as well, though, you know, that we have a, you know, science is our only guide to objective reality. Presumably he wasn't exactly a great fan of that either.
No, not because he was against science, but because he was against the overvaluation of a particular scientific paradigm. You know, science is only as good as the means of study that it brings to its field of inquiry. And those modes of inquiry need to be kept under constant review. And yes, although we're trying to gain understanding of objective reality, it's still the case that we understand reality as subjects. You know, you and I are necessarily confined to a particular perspective, and we need to recognize that humbly and therefore adopt a due provisionality about any conclusion that we come to. And I think that it's that provisionality and humility that Lewis thinks that some scientists or scientists, you know, the followers of scientism, do not keep fully and duly in mind. They begin to, you know, as it were, rest on their laurels. Oh, this has worked for us in the past. Let's just keep continuing to apply this paradigm ad infinitum. But of course, science progresses by revolutions. You know, the structure of scientific revolutions, that great book by Thomas Kuhn, speaks very much, I think, to Lewis's attitude to science.
And the title itself, The Abolition of Man, talk about that, because ultimately Lewis is saying there is a givenness to who we are, to the value we embody. And obviously, although he doesn't necessarily put it in quite these explicit terms, you can find that terminating in the fact that God has created and given us our value and so on. What was he foreseeing would be this so-called abolition of that idea, this abolition of man? And where do we see it, I suppose, reflected in our modern culture?
Yes, he calls his book The Abolition of Man because he thinks that recognition of objective value is the definitively human faculty. We are rational animals. We are unique in the universe. Angels have rationality, but angels don't have bodies. Animals have bodies, but they don't have rationality. And so we are this composite creature with a rational head and a sensual belly. But between the head and the belly, we have this definitively human faculty, which he calls the chest, which is the liaison officer between reason and passion. And it's that chest which links the angel and the animal and gives us the anthropological. And so that's his argument. If we fail to integrate our reasons and our passions, then we either evaporate upwards into false spirituality or descend downwards into bestiality. And either way, our manhood, our humanity is abolished.
And in the process, I think his great concern was that if we become so flexible, so moldable, the concept of who we are as humans, it effectively, we hand over power to whoever is the leading power broker. You know, we will be molded by others. If there is no objective standard, it will be whatever culture, society, science, whatever decides we want to be. I think I even seem to remember he sort of, you know, developed this whole thing in his science fiction trilogy, especially in the last book, That Hideous Strength, where he talks about the potential pitfalls of science to decide the future of humanity and what we are going to be and such like.
Absolutely, yeah. That Hideous Strength, he says explicitly, has behind it a serious point that I have tried to make in my Abolition of Man. It is the kind of fictional counterpart to the philosophical argument that he gives in Abolition. And yes, if we go down this path, it all becomes a question of power. Who has power to mold everybody else? And it's not that they are, you know, the conditioners, the innovators are a particularly superior kind of human being. If they have stepped out of the objectivity of value, then they are no more human than the rest of us. So it's not that we underlings are being conditioned by other men. They themselves are being conditioned by their irrational impulses. And so either way, the abolition of man is brought about, either directly or indirectly.
And again, Lewis, to some degree, predicting what we are now seeing, I think, in things like the transhumanist sort of movement and that sort of thing, where, you know, there are people who are saying, yeah, we need to sort of transcend the shackles of our physical nature. We can do what we like to our bodies. We can, you know, live forever in some, you know, digital universe or whatever. There's a sense in which, and the question is, what is the results of taking off those limitations in that kind of way? Do you think Lewis would have recognized, you know, what he wrote about, you know, in the 40s and 50s as having a sort of concrete realization today?
Absolutely, yes. He uses the word post-human at one point in the book. I think not transhuman. That development hadn't yet sort of raised its head on the horizon. But I think he saw where all this was possibly leading. And it's interesting that you mentioned the idea about, you know, living forever in a digital reality. Because at the root of all this, as I've been implying, is a desire for power, to recognize the objectivity of value is to recognize that there's something outside our wills that we need to conform ourselves to. We have to, as it were, surrender to reality, not impose ourselves upon reality. And, you know, the absolutely crucial question in this regard is, of course, our own mortality, that we have to recognize that we are mortal. We are going to die. We may not want to, but so what? It's going to happen to us anyway. It's an objective reality. And so it's interesting that in The Abolition of Man, Lewis repeatedly circles back to the question of death for a good cause. Dying for one's country, he says, is the crucial test of the objectivity of value, because when you have to suffer for doing the right thing, it's revealed to you that what you believe is indeed subjective. If it were merely subjective, then you would change it, wouldn't you? So that you didn't have to suffer or die. But when you do suffer and die for a good cause, for the right, that indicates that what you're talking about is genuinely objective, and that's why he repeatedly comes back to this Latin tag, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. It's sweet and seemly to die for one's country. And sometimes he sneaks in Jesus's words about greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. That's the crucial test of the objectivity of value. And indeed, one of the things I try to bring out in my book is that Lewis himself had seen this up close and personal in the First World War. He'd been a soldier in the Great War and very nearly killed. Many of his close friends and comrades were killed. So he'd sort of tested this principle on his own pulse. He had seen men die for their country, and it hadn't shaken his belief in the objectivity of value.
So much more we could talk about regarding the guide you've written to The Abolition of Man, Michael. But thank you very much for this brief foray into it. It's sort of a double sort of whammy if you get both of the books by ordering from Word on Fire, isn't it? Just explain again what people will get if they follow the links.
Yes, wordonfire.org/humanity is the website to go to. And there you will get not only my guide After Humanity, but this free complimentary tie-in edition of Lewis's book with a matching cover. So make sure to order through Word on Fire. Don't go to Amazon, because I think through Amazon you're not so sure of getting the tie-in edition.
Okay. Well, always good to support from the source anyway. Thank you very much for the time. I was delighted to be introduced to a new Lewis work that will now sit on my shelf. And as you say, it's extraordinary how prescient the issues remain today. And as you bring out in your own in your own guide to it. But thank you very much for being with me on the show today, Michael.
My pleasure, Justin. Thanks.
Thanks for being with me on the C.S. Lewis podcast this week. Next time, you'll hear a lot more about the film that Michael mentioned, C.S. Lewis, The Most Reluctant Convert. I'll be bringing you my interview with its lead actor and writer, Max MacLean. So don't miss that next time. And don't forget that if you like Thinking Christianity, we think you'll love Unbelievable Live with John Lennox on Tuesday, the 7th of December. You can join us from anywhere in the world for free and ask your questions of the renowned Oxford professor and thinker. Just register at unbelievable.live. For now, have a good week and see you next time.